So, hi everybody. My name is Joya Mukherjee. I'm the Chief Medical Officer of Partners in Health. I'm an associate professor at Harvard. And I think the fact that, you know, super glad you're here, this is a very important issue. I don't think it's caught fire yet, which is obvious by this relatively small group people here, but we actually need some legal language to help us grow this movement. It's not clear if the framework is it, but that's something that we have and we can work on together. Right now, we have kind of nothing. And so I think what I want to do is just share a little bit of the perspective of Partners in Health, which is an NGO that implements work alongside governments, together with governments. And our sort of struggle to really bring a human rights perspective in the work we do, which in our view is really a two-pronged approach, that the right to health really, it needs to engage and involve civil society to know their rights and to demand those rights, but that we also have to empower governments to deliver on those rights, because governments in the global south have become so weakened by structural adjustment, by the international financial institutions, by a lot of globalization, that people can demand the right to health, but if the government can't deliver, it's very, very difficult. And so our work is a very delicate balance between really trying to engage and support civil society, but at the same time trying to redo some of the structural impediments that are there for governments. So I want to talk a little bit about sort of what we see as the evolving sort of need for new standards in public health. And I think here we are at APHA, and we think of the great successes of public health, which are still really focused on prevention, things like John Snow's mapping of the cholera epidemic in London. Great success, but really very narrow, right? You take the handle off the pump, but what about the water, and what about the poor people who have no other access, and what about the women who now have 5 kids and have to walk, you know, an hour and a half instead of 10 minutes to get their water. So I think we have to look at health in a very holistic manner. And we were, you know, Partners in Health is about 30 years old now. And we started really in that sort of mode of the barefoot doctor, of really getting out and touching communities and really with communities. A lot of our work is still shoe leather public health, working with communities, saying, what do you need, doing community-based vaccination, community-based DOT for tuberculosis, et cetera. But I think over time what we found is working only with the patchwork of civil society when the health system was failing was just insufficient to address the real needs. And so we have, as an organization, evolved. And we've had the great fortune of working with activists like Eric and others, especially on the AIDS front, to really push the envelope in terms of deciding how to work with communities and at the same time empower governments to allow great things to happen. So I think you all know this story, but I think it's a very important thing to review when we're talking about a new paradigm, which would be a global framework for, you know, a framework convention for global health, which was where we were in 1978 with Alma Ata. The ideas of Alma Ata were quite modest, right? That people should be within half an hour of potable water, that people should have access to basic primary care. But that was undone within a year by the notion of selective primary health care. And a lot of that was GOBI, which is growth monitoring, oral rehydration salts, the promotion of exclusive breastfeeding until 6 months and breastfeeding to 2 years, and immunization. GOBI does not address the majority of the burden of disease on the planet. It addressed a very small sliver. And for many of us who are my age and older, that was sort of all that public health had to offer still, was this concept of GOBI. I've done GOBI. Some of you have done GOBI. I never want to do that anymore. Just walk around and tell mothers who have starving kids, look, if you only gave more leafy green vegetables, your kid would be okay. Because the overall social determinants of health are so not in that family's favor that all the education and simple stuff we can do is not going to address the actual health problems. And so that sort of approach, while it was considered sustainable, sustained what we have now, which is poor health and massive inequality. And I think without really having a framework to go forward, we are going to continue to sustain that. And I'm going to just use this little cute slide about sustainability. This was given to me by my friend, the Minister of Health in Rwanda. This is freely available on the web. But, you know, how many times in your life, if you're a global health implementer, have you been told what you're doing is unsustainable? For me, I think it now approaches 3,753,247. Because everything, the rubric that we have had until now is sustainable means that what we do has to fit in with the financing available by that government or you shouldn't do it. And so Eric just showed us that in places like Chad and also Haiti, where I do a lot of work, and Malawi, the public sector health spending is less than $8 per capita. So you could do a little infant vaccination, maybe a little tuberculosis control, a lot of vitamin A and some deworming, and that's it, and that's a sustainable. So unless we kind of break out of that notion, we are never going to really address the massive health inequalities. And so I get a little tired of the word sustainable, and I like this. So we are trying to move to what does it take to deliver, what is global health delivery versus kind of a more sort of narrow public health approach? And there are a couple of different things that come to mind for me and for us at Partners in Health. And this is just a couple pictures from when we suddenly had the epidemic of cholera in our midst in Haiti in 2010 after the earthquake. And what was interesting for me were several things. First of all, the epidemic of cholera broke out in an area that Partners in Health had been working in for over 25 years. Made us feel pretty horrible because we'd done a lot of water projects, sanitation projects, a lot of latrine digging, a lot of Gobi, right? A lot of... And we couldn't prevent a massive epidemic. Why? Because there isn't municipal water supply in Haiti. There isn't a municipal water treatment, sanitation. So a little water project here, a little water project is not going to protect that population from cholera. The other thing that was interesting, however, was we also found it first. Why? Because we had invested a lot of our efforts with the government in developing a public sector strategy. So we had constructed, revitalized, revamped 11 public sector hospitals in rural Haiti, right along the river, many of them, and invested in a health workforce, Haitian doctors, Haitian nurses, Haitian community health workers, who all were jointly paid by the government and Partners in Health. So when they suddenly saw 900 cases of adults with profound diarrhea, they knew something was wrong. But if there was no health system, it would have taken even longer to find those people. So now we weren't prepared. We had people sleeping in hallways and everything, which was pretty awful. And within some period of time, we had to put together a cholera treatment center, which for us was very new. But again, it takes infrastructure to do that. So addressing the actual burden of disease, not just the simple burden of disease, I think for us is where we really want to say, you know, if we want to address inequality, we have to deal with the burden of disease as it comes to us. And we all know if you've been spent 10 minutes in any hospital anywhere in the world, you still see cancer. You still see heart disease. You see all kinds of things, not just, oh, does this have measles or not? Were they vaccinated or not? So the real burden of disease. And attention to social determinants. I think it's naive of us to continue to think that if we don't have general economic equality, we'll have health. We can't. It just, they have to be done together. And then, as I mentioned already, the collaboration between government and civil society for a real rights-based approach, and to have an equity agenda. So not to pat ourselves on the back with this aggregated data and say, wow, you know, 80% of kids are vaccinated, because it's the same 20% of kids that are still not vaccinated, are still dying of malnutrition. So we have to have an equity agenda, which to me means that last mile, that last 10% or 20% that we're always missing, whether it's in the United States, in Pine Ridge, or in the Bronx with diabetes care, or in rural Africa. So I think our thinking has evolved, and I think this is why we very much support the idea of a global framework. You don't have to read this busy slide, but as I talked about, we were very much a kind of community-based primary healthcare organization, and we stumbled upon the fact that the burden of disease was way too complicated for that approach alone. And our first foray into that was with drug-resistant tuberculosis, where we actually needed more drugs, laboratories, trained physicians, x-rays, you know, and all kinds of things that people said too complicated, not sustainable. We said, you know, and luckily for us, TB is contagious and it's airborne. And so people sort of say, well, okay, you can treat that, but not this, right? So I think we have to, you know, try to push the envelope, and we started to really make advocacy for change in price, because the trade laws have to be changed. It's non-negotiable. You can't have commodities that are life and death things where millions of people are suffering for lack of something that should be considered a public good. So that, you know, started our real advocacy around international trade. That's, I think, when I got to know Eric and others on looking at how to implement TRIPS, the trade-related aspects of intellectual property, into national law to give countries some legal framework, again, a legal framework to fight some of the corporate interests. But as we worked more and more with advocates in HIV, all of us were collectively successful in raising lots of money for HIV treatment. Again, people said not sustainable, too difficult, but today there are more than 8 million people receiving antiretroviral therapy, and most of them are receiving it for free. Now, I think that's a great success, and we should celebrate it. However, it's only a foot in the door. I don't think AIDS treatment is good, and it, you know, it's bad because it takes money away from other things. We need the same advocacy and more advocacy for other things, for primary health care, for women's health, for the social determinants. And I think we should, rather than pit HIV against other things, we should say, how can we work together to broaden that movement, to bring in more people? I've had women, I was at an American Medical Women's Association conference a few years ago, and a woman said, well, HIV was so easy because rich people have HIV too. And I mean, it just made me laugh, because it certainly wasn't easy to get the Global Fund and PEPFAR and massive treatment. And I said, well, you know, this is a convention of women. How many of you have had a cesarean section? You know, and about 25% of the women in the room raised their hand. And I said, so there's a condition that affects rich people too. Why is it that you are not fighting for your sisters in the South? I mean, we can use international solidarity for many things, right? Many things. HIV activists just happen to have that solidarity for a number of historical reasons, and because there's some great people there, but we can build that kind of movement around lots of things, around childhood illness, around, you know, women's health, et cetera. But, you know, when we first got our first tranche of money from the Global Fund of Partners in Health, we made a very clear strategic decision that we weren't going to put money into our charitable complex anymore and build more charity hospitals. We said we're going to invest in government structures. And so we took that money and started to revitalize the public health system in Haiti, along with the Haitian government. And it was based on that that we were invited to Africa, because what a lot of African governments saw was PEPFAR money came and American NGOs just poured into the landscape, taking the money away from what could have been a national centralized approach that would have had an equity agenda. I mean, not in all governments, but and that's the narrative. So we were invited to Rwanda, then Lesotho, Malawi, to sort of implement the same model whereby an NGO can work perpendicularly, integrating our strength and resources within a public system to kind of lift that system up. And so we've done that, and now today we've helped to revitalize and rebuild more than 70 hospitals and clinics around the world in many different countries in the public sector, and still engage community and employ community members as community health workers and other types of workers, non-health workers. But I can tell you, as we open more doors to more hospitals with more governments, we see more disease and a more complex burden. And this is where the human resource crisis even becomes more vivid. Because if you don't have, if all your health workforce has ever been trained to do is GOBI, it's very complicated then to treat congestive heart failure. And so we have recognized that more money needs to be spent, again, we would argue, in the public sector to capacitate health workers and keep them in country. And we've been able to do this in Rwanda with the government using American dollars, which is somewhat shocking, going directly to the government of Rwanda to try to build an 8-year plan to rebuild the Rwandan health workforce. And the government has a plan for training and a plan for retention of those workers in the country. So without a bond, by the way. So, I mean, I think that it, for us, it has naturally become part of this idea of having a framework for global governance, not this idea that you as country X are totally, you know, every tub on its own bottom, and you got to figure out your the next 50 years of your health program with $8 per capita, because it won't work. So I'm going to skip over a couple of things because I think you guys know about HIV and TB and some of these things, but I think this idea of using, we have used HIV, and we say it all the time in Haiti, as our battle horse. The battle was never about HIV. We are not an HIV organization. But the battle is against poverty and ill health, and we've used money and attention from HIV to put it into general health system strengthening. It won't work anymore. Okay, we have reached the limit of that. And the reason is because so many people are in treatment. So the money for HIV now is pretty much all going to sustain people on treatment, which is great, right? But when we had lots of money and we were just finding cases and enrolling, we could use it and spread it around. Now we need a new step. And if you think about the Global Fund particularly, more than PEPFAR, as a real paradigm shift in terms of money that was coming from the Global North and was redistributed to the South and often to governments, you know, often to support the public sector, often even against the public sector spending caps that had been imposed by the international financial institutions. It was a paradigm shift. So we need something akin to that and to still work on the ways that we structure health financing. So we can see that financing for global health has gone up over the last couple decades, which is great. And in our view, is a lot of this is solidarity activism, but we've plateaued, and that's not great, because we've plateaued largely on the backs of the activism around HIV. So it is up to us, up to people who care about this issue, to get out there and try to have a new strategy. So the idea of bringing people together around a framework, I think, is a strategy that could work. It's a strategy, as was done with tobacco, can highlight the problem, can call for international responsibility. And, you know, human rights has not gone through a new evolution, in my view, as a relative student of human rights, since the 60s, when we came up with the covenants. And the covenants, remember, on civil and political rights and on social and economic rights were highly divided along Cold War lines. But it's very much time to bring those two covenants together and say, you cannot have political and civil rights without social and economic rights. You can't really have health without the social determinants. You can't really have good health without having jobs, having water and sanitation, and fight for a sustained framework. And health can be one of our metrics for that framework to exist, but the other metric has to be a globalized notion for who's going to be held accountable. Because the human rights of the 40s, 50s, and 60s was very much a national government only. And we have to really look at the duty bearers and the responsibility that we all have financially and morally to make this happen, because we can't let this plateau stand like that. So, you know, we had a framework, the Millennium Development Goals for the health side, which was okay, not great. I thought they were highly unambitious, and I used to make a lot of fun of them, and then I realized they were the best thing we have out there. And there are some shining examples. One is the country I do a lot of work in, Rwanda, of countries that are meeting the MDGs. But on aggregate, Africa is behind. Why is it behind? Because of extreme poverty. Right? So we have to really address, and I think one thing that's interesting is AIDS is one of the least behind of the MDGs, and that's because it has a funding stream. So let's not kid ourselves. We are constantly in public health and global health beating up on countries for not meeting the MDGs, but there is only one MDG that implicates the rest of the world, and that's MDG number 8, the Global Partnership for Development. And nobody talks about that. You see report cards all the time with Lesotho and Rwanda, and they're not meeting MDG 5, and they're meeting MDG 6, and they're not doing this and that. But what about our responsibility in the global north as countries that are wealthy and control these international trade and financial structures? Because our partnership is failing. It's non-existent. We don't see an increasing partnership. We don't see an increasing responsibility. And I feel like this framework convention can address that, can give us some metrics. This is just an example of Rwanda's extreme drop in child mortality since the genocide, which is pretty profound and terrific. But, you know, so what if our report card on MDG 8, as we go into the new millennium, this idea, or the new phase, the sustainable development goals, is some of this language from the framework? the non-discriminatory trading and financial systems. We know that it makes a difference. These are things that were put out there for MDG 8, but we never held the Global North accountable for these. Free access for the least developed countries for export, enhanced debt relief, more generous ODA, that's pretty vague. You know, so I think we have to really think about that. So from our perspective, a global health treaty based in the right to health to enable international actors to support governments with a strategy for mutual accountability, include civil society as participants and really meaningful actors, as we have seen in the AIDS epidemic, and move beyond what is sustainable based on national country budgets, but would establish legally binding standards that to which both, you know, parties are accountable. So I think when we talk about getting to 2015, not having met most of the MDGs, moving into this idea of sustainable development goals, they're not out there yet. We have a window of opportunity to say what we want them to be. There's concepts, but they're not written. And, you know, I think this concept of universal health coverage is incredibly important, and what that is, and not having a very narrow, nihilistic approach, and involving communities of great need, because they'll tell you what they need. So for us, you know, we think there is always a framework for social change that has at least three parts. One is the having the scientific knowledge. We know how to do a lot of this stuff, and we know we need staff, we need stuff, and we need infrastructure. And to do that, we need money, we need accountability. We need a strategy for social change, and I think that's what Eric and others at Jolly are trying to work for. There are other groups as well, but, like, let's get around something. It doesn't have to be perfect. You know, the Global Fund isn't perfect. But we have to say, without, you know, we are the good guys here. So we have to sort of put our heads around something and say, let's fight for this. And then bring in the key constituencies. And some of those have to be voices of people from the Global South and communities of great need. And then generate the political will and find the right allies to make the case for social change. So thank you very much.